Commonwealth. Mr. Oskin, Mr. Gerald.
Your Honors, good afternoon.
Would you like to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, Your Honor. I'd like to reserve 5 minutes.
All right.
Your Honors, good afternoon. Attorney Paul Roskin for Marquise Cook, the appellant in this matter. The facts in this case are fairly straightforward, and I'm sure a scenario that the court has seen many times over the years in criminal matters. You have a situation where you have a robbery. Robbery occurs at night. There was a single gunman, although he was not, the defendant was not convicted of using a gun, but the victims seemed to think a gun was used. They were seated inside their darkened car. Lighting was very poor. Half of the gunman's face, half of the face of their assailant was obscured. The jury convicted. There were several different charges. The jury did not convict on. They convicted on two facts, the carjacking and the robbery of the cell phone. And there were other facts that the jury did not convict on, including all the charges related to one of the two victims in Mr. Flowers. So the only two things that they found beyond a reasonable doubt that was that Ms. Sutu was convicted, was robbed and had her cell phone taken. Her car and her cell phone. Well, according to the facts, that was significant. Her cell phone being taken, she runs down the street, finds someone with the phone, makes a call. The call is to the local police. Within a matter of minutes, she is informed by the police officer, whose testimony at the trial read as follows. I'll just verbatim. The question was, you told them that you had a potential suspect for them to view, didn't you? I said we're going to look at somebody who was driving, who was found driving the vehicle. Exactly. You told them that before you saw my client, right? You told them that on the way over. Yes. So they knew that he was caught in the vehicle that was carjacked. Right.
Well, let me ask you a question about that.
Yes.
Because it seems to me that there's a conflict in the evidence on that question. And given the procedural posture that the case is in, don't we have to resolve that factual conflict against you? Ms. Sutu or Soto says she wasn't told that. Given that we have to view the case in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, don't we have to accept her version?
I think we do if the court, in making its findings, had weighed the evidence, had weighed the testimony of Ms. Sutu, and had weighed the testimony of the officer who conducted the investigation, and had found Ms. Sutu to be more credible. What the court said specifically in making its findings was it was relying upon the findings based on what was heard at the motions hearing a year early. That was the specific statement of the trial judge when she made her findings. I'm relying on what was said at the motions hearing. The problem is this testimony never came out at the motions hearing. So that's number one. And number two, it was a different judge, a different jurist, who would have been weighing credibility at that hearing. So at this point, we have the trial judge, by her own statement, saying she's relying on what was said at the motions hearing. So the problem is, we don't know whether she did not believe the officer, or whether she just felt as a matter of law that it didn't make a difference, one way or the other.
But with the absence of a specific ruling on that, then isn't the default that as appellant you lose any potential way that you can lose? And that's a tough way to say it, but appellants come here with a heavy burden and appellees get lots of breaks.
That's true, Judge. And I would submit that had she not made that specific ruling, had she not specifically said, I'm relying on what was said at the motions hearing,
If Ms. Sutu's version is correct, does the show-up identification violate Neal versus Biggers?
I think, honestly, if Ms. Sutu's, if her recollection of what happened is correct, it's a much tougher burden for me to argue that. I think there are still certain factors here that are obviously very troubling. We have the fact that they are taken to the scene within a few minutes, which obviously favors the identification. But we have a single defendant. We have him in handcuffs. We have him literally walking distance from where the motor vehicle, where Ms. Sutu has found her motor vehicle was found. He's wearing a bloody shirt. He's wearing bruising. And I think any reasonable person going to the scene would conclude that this was the gentleman that was found with the vehicle, even if the officer hadn't said that. I don't see how any person looking at that would somehow conclude that this was just a random person picked off the street. He's literally walking distance from the vehicle. The second problem...
Counsel, isn't she very specific about how she identifies him, and doesn't she, even though he had a bandana or something over his, she had the opportunity, you said it was dark in the car, but there was actually a light on, the car light, and he leaned over her, so he was within inches of her, so she had a really good opportunity to observe a lot of things about him, didn't she testify to that, I think?
And Judge, that goes to the separate issue, which is, did her observations overcome the level of prejudice that was cooked into the way that this was done? And I would submit several factors regarding that. Number one, the existence of a mask covering half the face is an undisputed fact. The existence of the time that they had to encounter, which was basically a minute or so, is an undisputed fact. And the fact that the lighting was so poor was an undisputed fact.
And that's best resolved by the fact finder, who has a chance to view the witness as she's giving her testimony and weigh what she has to say. Is that a fair statement as opposed to an appellate body looking at a cold record?
Well, that's two separate issues, Your Honor. That's two separate issues. When you say the fact finder, we're talking about the judge, we're talking about the jury who's deciding guilt or innocence. If we're talking about the jury, obviously, there are facts that they're hearing that are
well. It really kind of applies to both, doesn't it? Because to get to the jury to begin with, it's got to get past the judge, who then determines whether or not something was reliable enough to be put before the jury, and is in a far better position to make that call than we are.
Well, again, you still go back to Biggers, which is a question of law. It's not a pure question of fact. But
on the motion, we're here on a motion to suppress.
Yes.
So it's not a jury question in that sense. But yes, although we review the legal import of any facts found during the motion to suppress de novo, we're bound by the trial court's findings of fact, are we not?
We are, Judge. And the trial, Judge, we're not disputing that the trial court found that her testimony to be credible regarding her ability to ferret out the person's view based on facial features. And that's not in dispute. The question is, as a legal issue, can we say that that's sufficient? Merely the statement of the person that I can tell by looking at them in the eyes, or I can tell there was something about his eyes. That was the full import of what was said. That the person opened their eyes and they looked at the eyes and said, well, I can tell by looking at the eyes. And yes, the fact finder is given deference in that. The problem there is then you open the door that could be true in every case, regardless of how prejudicial. In fact, I would suggest that the more prejudicial the lineup, the more certain the person who's influenced by a prejudicial lineup is going to be.
Before we eat too much into your rebuttal time, just so Ms. Fitzgerald has a chance to respond to some of this, if we buy everything that you're selling, how is it not harmless error, given all the evidence in this case?
Well, Judge, when we say all the evidence, it's not harmless error because we have these were the only eyewitnesses. Now, you're talking about harmless error has to be proof beyond a reasonable doubt that it was not harmless error to 12 citizens. So can we say beyond a reasonable doubt, if I took 12 citizens who looked at these facts without an eyewitness identification?
So except that you've got him driving the car a very short period of time after the robbery. He gets out of the car. He flees from the police. He is later caught in possession of Ms. Soto's cell phone. And then to accept his version, you have to believe his self-serving testimony that somebody else gave him the car and apparently the cell phone, too, to get rid of.
Well, you might have to. The question is, if I have 12 people and I don't have DNA and I don't have a confession and I don't have an ID, can I say beyond a reasonable doubt, not us in this room, but 12 jurors sitting in the city of Petersburg.
What does DNA do for you in this case when he's found with the possession of the stolen items, including the car and the cell phone?
I'm sorry, I suppose the DNA is not the best. I would agree with you on the DNA, but we still do not have an ID.
If I understand your argument on harmless error, you can see the evidence if we take out the IDs, if we just say they don't get to testify at all, would still be, given the larceny presumption and all that, would still be more than sufficient. It's just not, we can't say that the inclusion of the other fact was harmless.
There are two issues to that. Number one, we can't say it's harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. And number two, the case law, there's certainly ample case law on larceny. There is some case law certainly on burglary. I could not find a single case where that doctrine was extended to armed robbery. So whether or not a jury would even have been instructed on that seems to me an open legal question. I was not aware that the jury would be allowed to make that presumption. Maybe some jurors would jump to that presumption, but I don't know that they would be given an instruction because under existing case law, I don't know that that doctrine's been extended.
We've almost eaten up half your rebuttal time. You're welcome to continue talking. You're welcome to save it.
Judge, I'll step aside to save it, so I do have a couple minutes left. Thank you.
Ms. Fitzgerald.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. May it please the Court, Elizabeth Fitzgerald on behalf of the Commonwealth. The trial court did not err in denying the defendant's motion to suppress in this case. Under Supreme Court case law, the defendant has the burden in these cases to show both that the show-up procedure was impermissibly suggestive, unduly or unnecessarily suggestive, and also that the identification itself, even with those corrupting factors, wasn't sufficiently reliable to allow it to go to the jury. I would submit the defendant in this case did not meet his burden with respect to either of those tests. And I'd also argue, as you did on brief, that even if the trial court was wrong in this case, the exclusion of that testimony would have been harmless beyond a reasonable doubt, given the exceedingly strong circumstantial evidence in this case. With regard to the suggestive nature of the lineup itself, the trial court recognized, as have multiple other courts, that lineup procedures are suggestive by their nature. And the question is whether this was gratuitously suggestive, whether it was impermissibly or unnecessarily suggestive. And here we have a rapidly evolving criminal situation with an armed robber who's already demonstrated dangerous and reckless behavior in his flight from the police. He is hiding in a residential neighborhood and he is armed. If the person in the back of the car was not the carjacker, the police needed to know that information as soon as possible. And any time taken away from that could be time where this person who has already demonstrated a willingness to elude could further elude the police. And there's kind of the necessariness of that situation has been acknowledged in United States Supreme Court precedent in Simmons and also the Seventh Circuit case, Sanders, that we cited in brief. This was a necessary procedure under the circumstances, given how tight the timeline was that we were working with here and how the police came to be in possession of the defendant. The defendant being seated in the back of the car in handcuffs does not necessarily make this an unduly suggestive procedure. Again, as the trial court noted, some of these precautions were necessitated based on the defendant's own actions. He fled the police. He fled on foot. He, had exceeded 100 miles an hour driving through downtown Petersburg. And significantly, neither the victims in this case noticed he was handcuffed or attached particular significance to it. And they said they were focused on his face, which is appropriate given that all they could see in the car was his eyes, was his eyebrows. Both victims commented on his eyes, and Flowers commented on his bushy eyebrows.
And realistically, if you're engaging in a show-up, you don't expect it to be some person off the street that they just yanked in.
That's correct, Your Honor. This court recognized in Smith, and the United States Supreme Court has recognized also that by its very nature, whenever we're viewing a photographic spread, when we're viewing a photo lineup or show-up as we have in this case, a reasonable person would assume that the police are bringing them in for a purpose. And Professor Lefebvre has noted that as well. So the fact that these people were told, I would submit in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, told that they were going to be viewing a suspect, doesn't increase the suggestiveness of this procedure because they already presumably knew that when they were going out there. I think the court fully understands my argument on this point, but again, when we have a conflict in testimony between what Detective Walker told, testified to at the suppression hearing and testified to at trial, at this point, all inferences flowing to the Commonwealth, I believe that that record, as this court should look at it, should show that Detective Walker did not tell them there was a suspect in the car. And tellingly, neither victim said that they knew that. So if perhaps that was said, the fact that neither victim said that they knew that information going in, I think significantly weighs in favor of the Commonwealth on that standard. The bigger factor is this court doesn't need to reach the independent credibility of the identification if the court finds it was not impermissibly suggestive. But briefly, I would note that we don't really have I'm not sure that counsel's recitation of the facts were fully in the light most favorable of the Commonwealth. There's no evidence they couldn't see what was going on in the car. In fact, Sodhu testified unequivocally at the hearing that the dome light illuminated the defendant's face from behind, that she could see him, that she was within inches of his face for 3 to 5 minutes while he was in the car, and that was certainly enough time for her to form a clear picture of his eyes, which is how she later testified that she identified him. We have a very close in time identification here, 15 to 20 minutes total. And also, both victims testified unequivocally that this was the person. So we certainly have the certainty factor, the close in time factor, the ability to identify him. And again, these are crime victims, not casual passerbys, so they were certainly paying attention to what was happening to them. So I would submit that under those circumstances, these identifications were independently reliable. And finally, even if the court was wrong in that sense, what we have here is evidence that is certainly harmless beyond a reasonable doubt. The police get behind this vehicle within 5 minutes of the robbery happening. Sochi testifies that it takes her less than a minute to run up the block to find them. They're already there. The officers testify that the bolo goes out and they are behind that car, the Be Clear vehicle, within 5 minutes. The defendant admits that it's him that's driving it. He eludes the police at a high rate of speed before eventually being apprehended on foot, and he has the victim's cell phone in his pocket. His flight from officers in combination with his recent possession of both the cell phone and the vehicle certainly in this case would form a strong circumstantial case that would be sufficient to kick the defendant beyond reasonable doubt.
Well, there's no question that it's, I think, given all the facts you said, that the evidence would be sufficient. Harmless error analysis isn't sufficiency analysis. There's another step to it. Can you briefly address that?
Yes, Your Honor. So in addition to it being sufficient, this court would have to find that a reasonable fact finder would find the defendant guilty beyond a reasonable doubt in these circumstances. And what we have here, again, with the strong weight of that circumstantial evidence, there is no issue that it's someone else. This is not a case where we have a he said, she said. This is not a case where there's DNA evidence required. The defendant admitted that he was driving the car. This is certainly a case where a jury, using their common sense and their common experience, could have reached and would have reached the same conclusion under these circumstances.
Because if the jury believes the defendant in his self-serving version, then the identification and the show-up don't even matter to begin with, do they?
That's correct, Your Honor. So this evidence is not, it's not a case that we have evidence that is cumulative in the sense that two people identified him and were taking out one. However, it is cumulative in the sense that if he's believed, it's not him, and if he's not believed, there is no one else. He is found in the car, he has the phone. The identification evidence really at that point is gratuitous. It's piling on, and any reasonable jury. And we have to assume in these cases, too, that this is a jury, it's not a lawless fact finder. Can't take into account during nullification or something like that. I think the verdicts in this case who knows why the jury came down how they did, and we can't look behind that verdict. But certainly when we're doing a harmless error analysis, we have to look at what a properly instructed jury would have done, and that jury is presumed to know and follow, or not know, but follow the law, as the case may be. So, but to the extent the court has an issue with the harmless error analysis, I think the Commonwealth's case is strong on the merits, and I'd be happy to answer questions from the court on either of those prongs. I've been talking fast, and I apologize for that.
Thank you. Counsel, you have some time remaining.
Yes, Your Honor. I'd focus on a couple of issues that were raised. One of the issues that was raised is this idea, and this deals with the second of the three factors, the second issue, which is the issue of the initial show-up, how it was conducted. The suggestion seems to be that because things are done so quickly that it had to be basically conducted in the manner that it was conducted. In fact, as was indicated, there were several things that really would not have taken any additional time. There's no suggestion that it would have taken any longer to have brought the defendant to, let's say, the police station or to where the victims were to do a show up there rather than right at the scene where the car was. I mean, it took time to transport the defendant to the victims to the scene. It could have just as easily transported the other way and not had the influence of the victim then knowing that the defendant was found right where the car was. So that's the first issue. Then we have the whole issue of how it's conducted. You have two individuals that are clearly in some type of relationship with each other, late at night, sitting in a vehicle. I think a reasonable person might presume they're dating, some type of romantic relationship, and yet we're conducting the show up where we're asking each one of them to identify the person right in front of the other person. So whatever the first person's speaking, clearly they're picking up on what the second person is saying. So that certainly adds to the prejudicial nature of the show up. I mean, if you're going to have two eyewitnesses in any courtroom, we always segregate them, we sequester them. Here that they did the exact opposite. They've been literally standing next to each other within earshot. And again, that totally unnecessary. Now, we could argue whether they could have cleaned this man up or not, time, because they didn't want to lose time. That's a debatable point, but I think the other two points clearly are not. I think they were both unnecessarily prejudicial factors that were thrown into the mix of this. The other point I want to address is going back to the harmless error analysis. I think this was a jury that carefully weighed each and every factor. And it convicted on only two points, which was the car, which we knew was taken, and the cell phone, which we knew was taken. And we knew that, as I said in my first remarks, because that's what the young woman used. She didn't have her cell phone, so she described running down the street. So the jury was certain beyond a reasonable doubt that those two things occurred.
Counsel, I'll let you go over a little bit to take 15 seconds to wrap up.
So I think that I don't see where harmless error, if we don't have the actual identification, I don't see how we can say beyond a reasonable doubt that the outcome would have been the same. So I'll just submit on that point.
Thank you. I'll just come down and recap.